Growing up, I didn't go to church on Sunday mornings, but on Friday nights, both my mom and I would sit down and watch movies, and she would show them from a Christian perspective.
Growing up, we were out in the woods, so I didn't watch many movies, but I learned to look around me and find a spiritual lesson in everything I saw.
So now, I want you guys to experience the goodness of God in the movies we watch.
Join us as we unpack meaning from the movies we watch.
I'm movie apologist Clark.
And I'm Bethany.
And this is Movie Night Apologetics.
Well, what is up, movie lovers? Welcome back to the podcast that loves to show you the goodness of God in the movies we watch. And today we're going to be going way out into the universe, and we are going to be exploring E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And this was recommended by yours truly, Clark and Bethany.
What an adorable introduction.
Sorry, Rachel. So for those of you who don't know, we were going to do Sonic the Hedgehog 3, recommended by Rachel, and we decided against it because Amazon said, hey, if you give us $20, we'll let you watch it. And I was like, nah, no, sir.
That's so, like four coffees.
Yeah, I mean, come on. I mean, that's like three, what is it called? The things I like at Dutch Brothers.
Oh, the caramelizers?
Yeah, the caramelizers. It's like three of those. It's like, I'm not wasting three of those.
Heck no.
Or it's like two Winco pizzas.
Oh, yeah.
So anyways, as always, we're going to be talking about the movie that we picked for the week. And we're going to be going over our ratings of the movie and go into the scenes and themes of it. But first, Bethany, why don't you give us our description of E.T. the Extraterrestrial?
So in E.T., an alien is left behind on Earth when his crew has to leave in a hurry. He's discovered by a boy named Elliot, who names the alien E.T., and Elliot's family discovers the special gifts that E.T. possesses. The family loves to learn E.T. and helps him build a device to call his crew to come back for him.
Did E.T. build the device?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, okay. I was trying to think for a moment, like, did the kids build it and how would they know how to do that? So
he put together like a toaster and an umbrella.
Right.
I think the kids helped collect the things for it.
Gotcha. I wonder how they knew, because did E.T. say, hey, go get me a toaster, go get me this? I mean, the dude could barely talk. How did they do that? How do they know?
Well, I don't know. But
how did E.T. know?
E.T. and Elliot had that connection, that mind connection. So maybe
right.
Elliot just knew that he needed those things.
Oh, okay. Well, we are going to get into our ratings of the movie. And so what we do on Movie Night Apologetics is we rate the movies based on water, which is bad, soda, good, and slushy, which is amazing. And so let's start it off with you, Bethany, and because this is for the listeners, we're doing something new where I have no idea what Bethany is going to say for her ratings, her movie facts, and all that jazz. So
yeah, we used to have each other's notes in front of one another, and now we have no idea. So everything's a surprise to us.
Yeah.
So E.T., I don't think I've ever watched this movie all the way through before because I didn't remember it being this good. I love this movie. I loved its deep sense of wonder. I loved the perspective. My rating is slushy.
Wow. I guess we'll get into the deep perspective in a little bit for you.
Yes. Specifically that it is a childlike perspective.
Yeah. Did you know, I mean, I didn't have this as a fun fact for the movie, but I did have this as a fun fact of the movie. But basically, to get ahead of myself from the child perspective, it was what?
I think this was one of my fun facts, too.
Dang it! All right, fine. We'll get in that.
Just get there when we get there.
So I actually also did rate it a slushy. At first, I rated it a soda because, it was because our kids kept talking through it. And I was trying really hard to concentrate as they're like, what's this? Why are you doing that? Why are they flying? What is his finger glowing. I was just like, ah, I need to watch the movie. So I didn't get the full weight of it as I normally would have when we do these because, you know.
You were distracted.
I was distracted half the time. And so, I mean, that's why I was asking you the questions of where did he come up with the toaster and whatnot. Like, how did all that work? Because I was kind of distracted from the kids talking.
Yeah.
And
so what was your excuse during There Will Be Blood for not realizing the major subplots?
I don't have an answer for that. I
was very suspicious.
Maybe because it was kind of slow and drawn out and my mind just kind of went elsewhere.
So this time you're blaming the children, but yeah, it really could be your brain.
Hey, you know what? You're the one to talk.
What?
We just saw Captain America the other night, and yeah, you'll hear about all the details in that next week.
You'll learn about all the details from Clark, because there's a reason why I didn't see the end.
Anyways, yes, I did rate it a slushy after thinking about the movie. One of the reasons why I think this movie is timeless in that it's is it considered a cult classic? It's got to be.
I don't know what really defines a cult classic, but it's definitely a classic.
It's definitely a classic. And one of the things that makes it a classic is that E.T. looks really realistic. And what the movie people did with the budget is they actually spent a lot of their budget on making E.T. and designing him, which makes a lot of sense because, honestly, he looked really real, didn't he?
He did. It was in a way that CG just can't equal. And that's one of the things I really like about this film, too, is they clearly used sets and miniatures and puppets in order to get across the same idea that we would now use CG for.
Yes.
So it all felt so much more authentic and touchable.
Yeah.
And like they were interacting with something real.
Right. Rather than an imaginary thing that they kind of had a picture like in Sonic, you know, like that was one of the big complaints in the Sonic movie, at least the first one, is that the characters and the Sonic CGI character didn't really feel connected. Like they were looking at empty space when they were talking to Sonic.
And with E.T., since they got to interact with an actual physical object, they had some actual reactions.
Emotions.
Emotions, reactions. Well, I was thinking specifically of the character Gertie, the little girl played by Drew Barrymore. When she first saw E.T., she said, "I don't like his feet," because he had wires coming out of his feet. And they left that in the film because they thought it was cute.
Yeah, that was cute. And which brings me to my point with this. Okay, so most people know how I feel about Disney live action. I think it's just, they're just money grab. Like they're money grabbing. They're trying to make a lot of money by, you know, making all these remakes from 20, 30 something years ago. And my thought was, what would make a Disney live action better? And the answer is in E.T. Because I think Disney live action should not use CGI. If they want to really go live action, they need to hire Steven Spielberg. And because Steven Spielberg, they get this, he created Jaws, Jurassic Park, the original 90s ones. He did do the newer stuff. He did Indiana Jones, Schindler's List, Hook, and then, you know, E.T. But what I'm saying is he made Jaws and Jurassic Park. Those were amazing because there was animatronics evolved. There wasn't CGI. It felt real. And I think if Disney really wants to amp up their game, they should hire Steven Spielberg to do this. I know it takes a lot more work, takes a lot more money. They obviously can't do as big of a production,
right?
You know, like you can't make 10,000 aliens and animatronics or whatever like they did with E.T. You can't make 10,000 of those that you can if you were to, you know, just stick with the CGI. But imagine if Disney was like, hey, you know what, we want to remake Lilo and Stitch. give it a little bit different storyline, and then make Stitch an actual animatronics like E.T.
Yeah, that would be way more watchable.
That would be worth watching. I mean, we're still going to go see it, unfortunately, because I guess I'm a sucker for nostalgia.
Oh, that's how they get us.
That's how they get you. Yeah. But still, I think Disney, you need to hire Steven Spielberg. That's it.
You spilled it. You got it.
Spielberg. And go back to the original Jaws, Jurassic Park kind of style. Make your live actions like that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's not live action if it still has graphics.
Yeah, exactly. Hello. It's like, hello, it's live action. No, it's not. Lion King is CGI and animated. It's just a little bit, looks more real.
I want real lions in Lion King. Like, I want them to just feed the lions peanut butter so you can get those movements where it looks like they're opening and closing their mouths. And stick some words in there. And you know what? The lions are not going to act right for you. So just like make up a script based on what it looks like they're saying
or,
and doing.
Or do something like Homeward Bound where they just had the dogs and the cat, but they just did voiceover. They're just thinking. That was great. Something like that.
That was great.
But we don't have to have their mouths moved. Like, I love Homeward Bound. I watched that movie over and over again. It was great.
Yeah, and we didn't need to see them like actually making the motions like they believed what they were saying.
Yeah. You know, it's just film the dogs like go on a journey and then put some voice actors in there.
Though what really carried that film was that it was filmed in Wallowa County.
And also that it was filmed by one of the voice actors was the Back to the Future guy. What was his name?
Oh.
Marty McFly.
It was Marty McFly
character. But anyways, like that's one of the reasons why this brought up the slushy for me. I mean, obviously back in the 80s they couldn't have CGI and the graphics and everything that we do now. But that's what makes these movies so timeless is that they look actually real. And I'm just really happy about it because, you know, when we look at movies now, it's like, yeah, that CGI sucks.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't make it feel real. And so, yeah. And, you know, the story itself, I'm like kind of torn on because, again, I don't know if it was just my experience watching it this time through, but I didn't really get as connected, and maybe it's because the kids were talking and my mind was somewhere else. I felt like it was a very short lived story. But
what do you mean?
Well, I don't know, like I didn't really feel the weight of the mothers or the mothers and the kids the divorce that happened with the dad. I didn't really feel that weight.
I don't think you were supposed to.
You don't think you were?
I was reading that Spielberg always puts in something about an absent father or a divorce in his films, if you're paying attention.
Hmm. And yeah, in Jurassic Park, there's kind of that, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think he wanted to dwell on it. It was just a fact.
I wonder if he's had an absent father and if he just adds that because that's kind of what's happened in his life.
Could be. And some people believe that E.T. is a father figure.
Hmm.
Meant to replace the father who's down in Mexico with Sally.
Mexico. You could have picked like Florida or something. You had to pick Mexico. I mean, it's just... Anyways.
Cheap eating.
Cheap eating.
That's why.
Yeah. You know, I've had I've had Mexican border food. And I'm going to be honest. Wasn't that great. And maybe... I've heard because it was pure, authentic Mexican, but I don't know. I liked Taco Bell better. I'm just be real with you on that one.
I'm going to let that stand alone.
Why you say that?
I don't want to be by your side when you get attacked.
Anyway, so that's our ratings of the movie. We're going to go into this section now, the fun facts. So we've already kind of spoiled a little bit of the fun facts, but...
That's okay. I think this is really a fun fact. So the voice of E.T. Was not a voice actress. The film's sound designer was at a camera store and he overheard this woman talking. And he was like, oh, she's perfect. And she was just this Californian housewife named Pat Walsh. And she smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day.
So that was the actual voice.
Well, I'm sure she like made it a little bit higher, but that raspiness, that was all her, all natural.
It's like, I think you should quit the smoking. I don't think it's good for you.
Well, it got her a role in a film, so.
Yeah, that's fair. I wonder how much money she made off of that. Well, my fun fact, as I kind of spoiled it a little bit ago, was that the most of this movie was actually shot from the eye level of a child to further connect with Elliot and E.T. With the exception of Elliot's mom, no adults or faces are shown until the last half of the film, which I pointed that out from...
You did, yeah.
From in the middle of the movie, I'm like, this is interesting. None of the adults' faces, except for the mom, were pointed out. And I didn't look a whole lot of research into that, but I almost wonder if it's because to make us feel like the real aliens in this movie were like the adults.
I think it has to do with the alienated experience of being a child. And unless adults get into your space, sometimes you don't see their face because they're up high, they're turned away.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it was actually trying to imitate the experience of a child.
Oh, okay. Huh. Yeah, I didn't think about that one.
Oh, so in the beginning of the film, Elliot lures E.T. into the house using Reese's. Mm-hmm. So the sale of Reese's actually tripled in the weeks after the movie was released.
Okay, so you know that I am a sucker for, I'm the guy that they're marketing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And you knew that somehow I would have chose this as my fun fact.
This was actually my third fun fact, but you took my viewing of the child perspective.
Well, your you fun just fact. Took my viewing of the Reese's flying off the supermarket shelves fun fact.
Well, did you have a backup fun fact?
No, I didn't.
That was my backup fun fact. So there.
Well, I am one of those suckers because honestly, so... We're recording this like a week after the Super Bowl, but last week, a day after we watched this movie, I went and watched the Super Bowl with Blaine, you know, and we were at the store and I'm like, you know what I really go for? I can go for some Reese's. So I bought Reese's and then I was on the treadmill after work and I see a Wendy's commercial about the son of the Baconator. And I thought to myself, while running and exercising and being all healthy and crap, I was thinking, man, I would really love one of those. And I was very tempted to go buy one of those. So
you are very susceptible to these kind of ploys.
I am.
Like anytime we're watching a show and anybody is eating anything, you're like, oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah, right, like 600-pound life.
Yeah.
Like all that like, they eat, are it looks amazing.
Right? The narration will be like, it's just a shame that they can't give up food because it has immobilized them. And Clark's like, oh, are they having some Reese's? Man, that sounds really good right now.
Or they'll have pizza or cheeseburgers. I'm like, man, that's really, it's really hitting home. Like, I really want some of what they're having.
Yeah. 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 You are what they're marketing to.
Yeah. So was that all the fun facts you had then, since I took one of yours?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all out of it. I mean, so there was a few other ones that just come to my mind. So both E.T. and King Kong were created by the same person.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which kind of makes sense because both of those, which is really weird because one's really small and the other one's really big. But both of them are like misunderstood creatures, like you were telling me. Mm-hmm. And I found that kind of intriguing. I didn't really dive in deeper on that, but right. I just thought that was interesting. Like both of them were created by the same dude. So that was a fun fact.
So moving on to scenes.
Well, hey, we gotta tell our people to rate and share the podcast because, you know, people here about the show if you share it, obviously. But then also when people are looking for a new movie podcast, the more that there are ratings, the easier it'll be for someone to be able to find the show. So if you could rate it 5 stars, that'd be awesome for us, because really we just want to come on here, talk about movies, and share the goodness of God that we see in them to help people to understand just God's goodness and kindness in our life. So that's all I want to say on that. But now we can go into the scenes and themes of the movie. So Bethany, why don't you start us off with a scene?
So one scene that stood out to me was near the end when E.T. is sick and all the scientists come in and they put the house underneath like a bubble. And we see the lead scientist in his suit, and he's lit up from below, so there's a lot of shadows on his face. He looks really scary.
Mm-hmm.
And then he looks at Elliot, and we can see the reflection of Elliot in the scientist's suit. Like, you can see Elliot's face over the scientist's face. And I wonder, is he seeing the boy in himself? Because later he talks about being, at one point he was a boy like Elliot, and finding an alien like E.T. was exactly what he wanted. So wow. I think it was literally about the scientist is a reflection of the boy.
Hmm.
Or the boy is a reflection of the scientist.
Yeah. So what kind of things do you pick up with that?
Well, it's not a theme.
Oh, it's not a theme. No.
It's a scene. Do I have to have themes for my scenes now?
I guess not. Just I didn't think about that, but yeah, that could be, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do you got?
One of the scenes that I had was the Elliot mentioning the dad is in Mexico with the girlfriend, and I had to look this up because I wanted to know. I always like looking up how old the casts are. It's one of my weird quirks I have with watching movies, is I always look at cast and if they're still alive, or if how old they are when they filmed it and how old are they now. That's just a weird thing that I do.
Oh, just admit, the only reason why you do that is so that you can point to a character on the screen and you could say, hey, you see that guy? He's dead now.
Yeah, you know, all those animals in Homeward Bound that you watched as a kid?
Stop.
They're dead now. Anyways, so I looked at the mom, and she was roughly around 34-ish at that age. Which
you mean when this was filmed?
When this was filmed, yeah.
Because I'm sure she was 34 at her age.
Okay, yes, you got me. She was 34 when they filmed this movie, and I'm assuming that she was portrayed as a 34-year-old Black Widow mother. I know, I'm... Not Black Widow.
No. That would have meant she killed her husband.
Right. I was trying to be funny.
Oh.
Because remember the other episode I said Black Widow?
Oh.
Right.
Yeah. No.
Anyways, no. I was trying to be funny. It wasn't funny. So I'm assuming that she was just a 34-year-old divorced woman. And she had, I don't even know how old the kids were. I think her oldest was...
Maybe 16.
16, which... tells me she got married really young and had her first kid really young. And yeah, like, I don't know. I'm just thinking through, like, she probably, maybe they weren't in love. Maybe it was kind of like a fling, and then they decided to get married because that was the right thing to do back then. And then it just, the dad was immature and he found someone else and took off to Mexico.
Oh, I so mean, you created this whole backstory.
Yeah,
for
I was trying. Well, because they don't tell us anything. So I'm trying to create a backstory in my head of like what could have happened. How could she have gotten to the point where she was at now when we first saw her in the movie?
Yeah.
Being single with a few, like 3 kids, and the husband's left in Mexico. So I'm trying to think, okay, she's 34. She was probably 19 when she had a kid. So I'm trying to figure out the puzzle pieces there.
Yeah.
And
yeah, could be.
Could be, John. Yeah, we don't know.
Nobody knows. I liked the scene where it's a Halloween night and everybody's dressed up for Halloween. And the oldest kid has a pretend knife in his head. And E.T. says, ouch. And he's trying to heal it. And they're like, no, no, it's just pretend. And that made me think about how when we dress up on Halloween, when we do decorations, we are kind of glorifying disgusting things.
Yeah.
And think about it from a child's perspective. You know, 364 days of the year, their life is all innocent and light and fun. And then one day a year, we're like, blood and fear and death. Like, that must be so jarring as a little kid.
Yeah, I would agree. Did you ever do any Halloween trick-or-treat kind of stuff as a kid?
I did, yeah.
Did you dress up as a gory thing with a knife in your head?
No. It was always something fantastical, like a princess, a fairy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the thoughts that Pastor Scott has implanted in me, he's like, we don't glorify evil. So he had, you know, talks with like his son about, hey, you know, dress up as someone that you want to represent, like Iron Man or Captain America or something like that. But you don't want to dress up as the devil. Why would you want to try to imitate or dress up with something that represents evil?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm one of those parents that is totally not against Halloween costumes or trick or treating. I think we can look at this and try to use it for God's glory. But, you know, we just have to be discerning and say, hey, let's dress up like people that we want to represent, mm-hmm. and not glorify death and wickedness and evil.
Yeah. And what does that say about our culture? That we do things that way. I think people like to celebrate Halloween with death and fear and wickedness because they're afraid of death. And it's the one day a year that they get to poke fun at it.
Yeah, like, ha, ha, ha. But the other 364 days out of the year, we want to keep that under wraps. We don't want to talk about death. I mean, we have people do funerals for us. We have people bury our loved ones for us. We want to keep death at a distance, but the reality is that death is always at our doorstep. And it's just one of those big elephants in the room that people don't generally talk about. We want to kind of like push it aside and off to the corner. Mm-hmm. But then just this one day a year, we'll hang skeletons out in the yard, and maybe not our yard, but other people will do that. And it's like, I don't know. It's just a weird,
it's just a weird time. I think it's bizarre that we're disconnected from both death and birth. Most people that I've talked to have never seen somebody die. And most people that I've talked to have never seen somebody be born. And that's not how we used to do things.
No.
That's not how people in countries that aren't developed do things. And I don't think we've benefited from disconnecting ourselves from that.
No, we haven't. I think it was that book that I was talking to you about by Dr. John Delaney about Own Your Past, Change Your Future. He talked about how they used to have like rooms set up in houses where it was for, you know, your loved ones, where you can go and they would like be in your house dead in a casket for days. Until you buried them. So you had the weight to process it. Mm-hmm. Now that's obviously you see them for a couple hours buried by someone else and then you move on. But there's no like grieving over someone's death and seeing that.
Yeah. It's unnatural that we expect people to have things we call celebrations of life. Don't cry that I'm gone. Celebrate that I lived.
Yeah.
Okay, but we need to cry that you're gone.
Yeah.
Or there's going to be something screwed up in us. Mm. My therapist told me that a whole lot of therapy is just mourning the things that should have been mourned.
Ooh. Oh.
Yeah. Dang. So, are we talking about E.T.?
Well, it kind of like sprung off of like the Halloween costume and the knife in the head. you know, why do we celebrate evil all the way to this? But yeah, it's, I don't know, it's just weird with the whole Halloween thing. I'm for like dressing up and getting candy, but the whole let's celebrate death thing, I mean,
yeah, if you're trying to scare people,
yeah,
like it's to jump out and scare somebody. Mm. That's funny.
Oh, okay. That's funny. I see how it is.
I happen to be really, really good at that. In fact, there was one time in our old church building that I thought you were coming in the door. So I waited at the bottom of the steps until the opportune moment. And then I jumped out and yelled. This poor audio tech guy staggered back with his hand over his heart. And then we just sat there laughing.
Wow. You thought, oh boy, I'm glad it wasn't me.
Yeah, if you're listening, I'm sorry, Kevin.
Oh, man. So one of my other scenes to pick up, you know, let's get back to the subject of E.T. is I honestly love the scene. Probably my favorite scene of the whole movie. I know there's classic scenes in it, but I think this one probably takes the cake on it, is when E.T. was drinking beer and Elliot feeling the effects of it.
That was pretty funny.
That was absolutely hilarious. And I don't know if the movie explained this, but did it explain if Elliot felt, or if E.T. felt the effects of Elliot? Like if E.T. bumped, or if Elliot bumped his hand and hurt it, would E.T. feel the effects, or was it just one way communication street there?
I feel like it was not clear.
Yeah, it wasn't really. I mean, definitely Elliot felt what E.T. was feeling, but yeah, we don't know about the vice versa effects on it. But the reason why I bring this up was it kind of made me think of Jesus coming to Paul in the book of Acts. So for people who don't know Paul, the apostle Paul, who wrote half the New Testament, at least in letter wise, he was a persecutor of the early church. And he was on this way to Damascus, or on the road to Damascus, and Jesus stops him and he says, "Saul, Saul," which was Paul's name before Jesus changed it, he said, "Why are you persecuting me?" And I love that, because you expect Jesus to say, "Hey, why are you persecuting my bride? Why are you persecuting my church?" But instead, we have the risen Jesus say, "Why are you persecuting me?" And it just kind of made me think of that Jesus in some ways is kind of like Elliot in this, because Jesus feels the effects of the people that are being persecuted by Paul, Saul, or Saul of Tarsus. And that just because we're in the midst of suffering, whatever it is, it may not be that you're being persecuted for your faith, right? You could be in the midst of suffering with a doubt or questions or loss of a loved one, whatever it is, and you're hurting, I do think that Jesus can feel the weight of that hurt, because it says that we're in Christ when we're believers. So if we're in Christ, like, Jesus feels the full effect of what we are going through. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I really liked that scene because it just made me think of that Damascus Road experience.
Yeah, you're not the first to draw a parallel between E.T. and Jesus. That came up when I was researching it, but I did not look into the reasons why. But that sounds like a really good reason.
I'm sure there's a few other reasons. Like, obviously, we'll get into
He came things. From above.
Yeah, he came from above. But yeah,
he wanted to heal.
Yeah, that, so.
He brought the dead to life. Oh, okay, yeah, there's actually a lot of
parallels. Well, yeah, there was a scene where he was about dead, or was dead, and then he came back to life.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, Jesus did die, and then he did rise from the dead. So.
And he brought those flowers back from the dead.
Yeah, so, yeah, he's a giver of life. A lot of parallels in this movie where E.T. represents, or is a parallel to Jesus. Obviously, he's not Jesus, but, I mean, he's a shadow of who Jesus is.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Right.
You ready for my first theme?
Yeah, let's get on to it.
So my first theme, which I think is the overall theme of the movie, is that facing the fear of the unknown creates curiosity and wonder. Mm. Because I saw in this film over and over again, the music and the shadows would make things look so creepy.
That first scene where Elliot meets E.T. and it's like foggy out, that would freak me out when I was Elliot's age.
Well, yeah, our three-year-old was like, turn it off.
You're right. Yeah, the fingers coming out. Like, yeah.
But the reason why it's creepy is we just don't know what's really happening. So there's the scene of E.T. in the cornfield, right? Mm. Where it looks like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to this poor kid? And then it turns out E.T. is a friendly alien and he's practically a stuffed animal. Or when we see the scientist coming into the house and he's lit up from beneath and he just looks terrifying. Like, what is he going to do? And the scientist tries to save E.T. And he tells Elliot that, you know, Elliot, you did the best job that you could. You're a very special boy. And over again, the character's ability to switch from fear to curiosity to wonder was rewarded. Like, everybody who could do that, they all got to see the ship carry E.T. away.
Oh.
Yeah. By letting themselves experience that whole journey, they deepened their relationships with one another.
Oh, wow. That's actually really cool.
Right. And it made me think about, the Bible says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Proverbs 1:7. Well, beginning of knowledge, depending on the translation, I'm sure.
Right. And then there's so much that's about the wonder of God. Like in Psalm 8, when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is my man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Like, being able to turn from fear to curiosity to wonder is a journey that I think we go through over and over again. Mm-hmm. And if we stop taking that journey, we get old.
Yeah.
I think that's when we truly get old. And one of my favorite theologians is G.K. Chesterton.
What? No way. This is the first time I'm hearing about this. Let me guess. I think I know what you're going to quote.
Do you?
Yeah. Is it about the God, you know, we're older than God quote?
No, that would have been a good one.
Oh, no. I'm kind of surprised. Now people are like, what kind of heresy did you say there, Clark?
You'll have to look it up. Chesterton's incredible. No, I wanted to quote his thing about we seem to think that being cool and intellectual means that we're not affected emotionally by anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were really to look at the universe the way it is, like, we should be shaking in our boots. Nietzsche had the strange notion that the greater and stronger a man was, the more he would despise other things. But Chesterton says, the greater and stronger a man is, the more he would be inclined to prostrate himself, to bow down before a periwinkle.
So, couple of questions. What's prostrate and what's a periwinkle?
Prostrate means to bow down.
Okay.
A periwinkle is a flower.
Ah, okay.
Right. So saying that, like, great people actually are filled with wonder over the tiniest things. You know, there's another part of this quote is, you know, every face in the street has the incredible unexpectedness of a fairy tale.
Yeah. Because can you elaborate more on that? Like, is it because there's so much story to unpack with the people that we meet in our lives that it would be so overwhelming that.
Right. Man, there's so much to answer there. So conception is a miracle. Mm-hmm. The fact that a baby reaches gestational age is a miracle. The fact that labor goes through smoothly and the baby is born is a miracle. It's absolutely a miracle that any of us survive childhood, because I think childhood is about actively trying to kill yourself and everybody around you has to stop you.
Yeah, if you have kids, you'll understand. You'll see our one-year-old pick up knives out of our dishwasher and just walk around with it. It's like, how did you not stab yourself or cut yourself?
And he goes straight for the knives too.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, forks and spoons and butter knives in there, and he'll just pick up the knife.
Yeah. Like, how incredible is it that any of us are here,
mm-hmm.
that any of us are alive, that we all have unique stories and thoughts and experiences. Every individual you meet is as unexpected as a fairy tale.
Yeah. Who was it? Was it Albert Einstein that says you can either look at the world as if there's no miracles, or you can look at everything as if everything's a miracle? Mm. I can't remember. I'm pretty sure it's Albert Einstein. We used to have it on a quote on our wall at SCL.
Oh, yeah. That's really good. Yeah.
Or maybe it was it. Or maybe it was Ed. No, it wasn't Ed Schweitzer. Okay. Ed Schweitzer didn't say that.
Good old Ed with all his big quotes.
Yeah. Oh, I like that a lot. I think one of the themes that I didn't really get this when I was watching it, but when I was researching, I was like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because one of the themes I picked up on was E.T.'s a healer. And this guy from Reddit, don't know his name, but I'm going to like quote him. He says, E.T. is a healer. He physically heals Elliot's finger. He heals plants. He tries to heal Mike's arrow through the head Halloween costume. And that brings me to the second layer. E.T. is there to heal Elliot's broken heart from his parents' divorce. And this has to be especially poignant with the surge of latchkey kids and divorces in the early 80s. And if no one knew what a latchkey kid was, I looked that up, and it's apparently when kids were at home alone without any adult supervision around because the adults were out in the workforce making money. So that's what a latchkey kid was. Mm-hmm. So, which I really liked his perspective there, is that E.T. is this healer. He'll heal things, and ultimately he's there to heal Elliot's broken heart. And that is exactly what we see the God of the Bible likes. It says in Psalm 147:3, it says he heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. In Psalm 34:18, the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. And so this just kind of reminds me that God's actually a healer. And it's not just a, you know, physical thing of like healing your hand or whatnot, but he actually wants to heal the wounds in your heart. Mm. And, you know, it's not some prosperity gospel thing like, hey, you know, if you accept Jesus, he's going to, you know, heal your cancer or anything. But he's there ultimately because he wants to heal you of your wounds, your past hurts. And because I truly think he wants to heal our whole mind, because it talks about he wants us to worship him with our whole heart, whole mind, whole body, whole soul. And, you know, part of our mind is distracted in all these different facades, like it's hard to follow him. And so I think Jesus does really want to heal us and guide us. But are we willing to accept the healing grace of God in that, like of the past traumas that we've had, of the sorrows that we carry? Are we willing to say, hey, Jesus, I need you to come in and just be a mentor to me in this area of brokenness? And like, obviously it's not going to fix everything. You know, you're not going to come to Jesus and it's going to be this perfect life that you're just happy all the time. But I do think, from at least in my experience, he can change your mind and heal your heart and your soul. Mm. So
that's really good.
Yeah.
My theme actually backtracks on that a little bit. I think this movie is a lot about how you work through difficult things as a child. Because so the whole film is shot from the perspective of a child, right? And we can see how helpless these kids are. Like, in that scene where E.T.'s sick and the kids have him in the bathroom and the mom discovers them, the kids are trying to explain what's going on, but they don't have the right words.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't explain to their mom why E.T. is not harmful and why he needs help. So she's just like dragging the kids out, and she can do that because they're physically helpless, right? So when you're a kid, your life is at the whim of the wills of people who are bigger than you.
Yeah.
And so you actually brought this up that you thought maybe Spielberg experienced divorce when he was little. And
for sure.
The actual inspiration for this movie was an imaginary friend that he created after his parents divorced.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Did you ever have an imaginary friend?
No.
I did.
I had a lot of imaginary scenes. I
haven't talked to that guy in a while.
Oh, is he still around?
I was an only child, so that's true. Forgive me.
Only I'm one of those weird.
I'm one of those weirdos.
So Jesus loved kids, right? Like when the disciples tried to shoo out the kids, Jesus was like, "No, like unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven."
Yeah.
And children are powerless, right? They can't do anything for themselves. And that was especially true in ancient times. Like, children had no rights. They had no status. They were completely dependent on the people who cared for them to provide everything they needed and to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
You know that scene in SpongeBob?
There's a lot of scenes in SpongeBob.
You know I'm going somewhere good, though, because I brought up SpongeBob. Okay, so there's this episode where SpongeBob is trying to impress his grandma with how grown up he is.
Oh, I love that episode.
Yeah.
Gosh, such a good episode.
No, thank you, grandmother. But at the end of the episode, SpongeBob rips off his fake mustache and he cries, "I want cookies. I want kisses on my forehead. I want my Milkies in a bottle." And you know what? Maybe when Jesus said that we have to become like little children to enter the kingdom, what he meant was he wants us to rip up our fake mustaches and admit we don't know anything. And we don't have anything that we haven't been given. And that all we can do is look at him, who is a being beyond our comprehension, in wonder and awe, and ask if we might have a cookie and a kiss on the forehead.
Hmm. I want cookies and milk after this. We have Oreos. I'm going to grab those.
I won't stop
you. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus says, you know, to be childlike, but not to be childish. There's definitely a difference in that. So don't take it as we're saying be childish, but to be childlike and full of like the wonder.
Wonder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wonder is good.
Yeah.
Wonder's a good thing.
So the other theme that I had for this, it's obviously it stares you at right in the face, is friendship and connection. Mm. And I'm gonna like quote this guy, that Jimmy Jaggles. So not only did Elliot feel what E.T. was feeling, but he had an emotional connection to him. And so Jimmy Jaggles says this: one of the central themes in E.T. the Extraterrestrial is the profound friendship that develops between the young boy Elliot and the extraterrestrial creature E.T. From the moment Elliot Taylor discovers E.T. hiding in his backyard shed, a unique bond begins to form. Initially, Elliot is frightened by the alien's presence, but curiosity and empathy lead him to approach E.T. with kindness and compassion. This act of reaching out marks the beginning of a deep and extraordinary friendship. And this kind of like has a little bit to do with what you're saying about, you know, going to the fear, to the curiosity, to the wonder. So it's kind of bouncing off that idea that you had as a theme of a little bit ago. And then he continues and says, as the film progresses, the emotional bond between Elliot and E.T. strengthens, transcending the barriers of language and species. Through their interactions, Spielberg portrays a pure and unconditional love that surpasses the realms of human comprehension. The scenes where Elliot and E.T. communicate, share experience, and feel each other's emotions resonate with the audience, highlighting the profound connection that can be formed between beings, regardless of their origins. And I'm almost done here. It's a little bit longer, but I had to like get the full scope of his quote. E.T., the extraterrestrial, serves as a metaphor, exploration of the universe, human need for connection and understanding. The film invites viewers to consider the possibility of meaningful relationships beyond the boundary of humanity by presenting E.T. as a relatable character capable of experiencing emotions, longing for home, and forming deep connections. The movie challenges our preconceived notions of what it means to be human and encourages us to embrace the unfamiliar. And that really got me thinking that Elliot was really good friends with E.T. by the end of this whole thing. You know, like you said, he started off with fear when he met him in the backyard, and then it sprung into curiosity in the house, and then was full of wonder there on after that. And I didn't think of this before, but he became friends with someone who he actually really knew little about. Yeah. I mean, just think about it. He didn't know why E.T. was there. He didn't know where E.T. lived in the universe. He didn't know if E.T. had a wife and kids and, you know, what were the aliens' purposes in the world and that sort of thing. Like, he had very little knowledge of who E.T. actually was, and yet he had a relationship with him. And that just makes me think of, you know, we can have a relationship with God without completely understanding everything about God and what he does. Because I think so many of us, I've been there at times where it's like, I got to have the perfect right theology. I got to like have all my dots in a row. I have to have all my T's crossed and all that to know actually who God is. And don't get me wrong, like, there's nothing wrong with theology. There's nothing wrong with doctrine. Actually, it is good, because if you can imagine what it would be like if Elliot stayed in fear of E.T. Because he had some form of knowledge that E.T. was not going to hurt him. If he had stayed in the preconceived notion that E.T. was out to kill him, he would have never formed a friendship with E.T. And so knowledge does help to some extent, but we can't have full knowledge of who God is. Like, Elliot can't, he didn't have full knowledge of who E.T. was, but he had some knowledge to be able to start to build a friendship from there. He knew that this alien that he'd never seen before was harmless and that he could be friends with it. And it says in the Bible that that God is friend of sinners. And the only people that really can't be friends with him are the people who are too proud to be friends with him, that don't want to be friends with him.
Yeah.
But if people want to be friends with them, then God invites them into that space. And then from there, they'll come to know who the real God of the Bible is. So I hope I'm not like ringing up any heresy bells and saying like, yeah, you know, all truth is, you know, all truth is your truth.
Relevant.
Or, like, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that we can't have, I don't have full knowledge of God. You don't, Scott, Pastor Scott or Emmy don't. Like, right. I actually had an
epiphany about that recently, because I've been having trouble praying, and I used to be really confident about who God was. I knew that he would be just like me, basically, and he would say the things that I say and do the things that I do.
Sounds like you're making God in your own image.
Oh, strange. So I wasn't curious about what he would say or do, because I knew. And I feel like I've lost my foundation, and I'm building it back together and realizing that I know very little about who God really is, and that the only way that I can get to know him better is to pursue him, to talk to him and wait for his answer. And by admitting that I don't know, I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah, and we talked about that in the car yesterday or the other day, and that was, I think it's really cool that there is some mystery to God. If we had everything figured out, like the Trinity, if we had that figured out, or if we had predestination figured out, or all these stupid, you know, debates that we have sometimes with in Christianity, I mean, if we had it all figured out, then what's the fun in, like, you know, coming to know God, like, at first in like fear, like, you know, and then going into the curiosity of discovering who God is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so fun. I think that's why, you know, I know evangelism or discipleship is sometimes really scary because, you know, you're talking with people that are unfamiliar with the God of the Bible, but it is so fun. Like I'm going through this one, I'm going through the chronological year long Bible with my friend Kevin, and he's read the Bible before, like years and years ago, but he's reading it now, and it's just really cool to see his eyes light up. Like, man, I can't believe like that happened in the Bible. Like, you know, just to see that curiosity strike, and then once you get that curiosity strike, and then you get the wonder of it. Like now I just look, when I'm reading the Bible, I just see so much of the kindness and grace and like the wondrous, amazing God of the Bible that, you know, 5 years ago I didn't have. It was all like, well, how does predestination work in this context of, you know, Moses asking God not to strike down the Israelites.
Let's
you know
put this into my narrative.
Right. Yeah. And so it's just cool to like go through it and like find out who God is and being comfortable with not knowing everything there is to know about who God is.
Yeah.
I think that's the most important thing.
That's what Spielberg came to about E.T. Because here's a bonus fun fact for you.
Oh, cool. We got a bonus fun fact. All right, go for it.
Originally, Spielberg was going to film a sequel. And it was going to be called Nocturnal Fears. And it was going to be about the kids getting kidnapped by these hostile aliens. And they were going to try and contact E.T. for help. But the aliens were actually trying to get E.T., whose name is Zurek.
Zurek.
Yeah, huh. Like Shrek, but with a Z. Doesn't that just ruin it?
That would have been horrible.
Yeah.
That would have been absolutely, that would have put a damper on the E.T. movie.
And that's why he decided not to do it.
Yeah, it was very smart. Thank you for not doing that. That would have just killed this movie.
Yeah, it would have.
Oh, man. So that's what we got for you guys today. Next movie, we're going to be going over just a timeless classic. I mean, you thought E.T. was timeless and classic and amazing. Well, you don't even know how wrong you are, because we're going to be talking about the best blockbuster hit since I don't even know when.
Your eyes are rolling. Your words are dripping with sarcasm.
But we went to the movie theaters this last week, and we saw the new Captain America movie, Brave New World, on Valentine's Day. And I'm just going to tease something. I'm going to be complaining a lot in this episode. A lot. I mean, my wrath just may come down on this episode.
Oh, no, not your
wrath. I mean, this may be as bad of a complaint as I had with 2001 Space Odyssey when I first made the first episode of that movie.
And I'm not sure anybody can talk you into otherwise. Certainly not
no,
me.
No, I don't even think Scott or Mark could talk me into that. Captain America Brave New World's this fabulous art piece.
But we'll have things to talk about.
So anyways, thank you guys for listening.
And like my buddy Meister Eckhart always says, indeed I say the soul will bring forth person if God laughs to her and she laughs back to him. To speak in parable, the father laughs to the son and the son laughs back to the father. And this laughter begets liking, and liking begets joy, and joy begets love. And love begets person, and person begets the Holy Spirit.
And like my buddy Blaine always says, after we get done with the movies, don't party too hard without me. What? Catch you guys later.
Bye.
Whether it's at home or at the movie theater, Movie Night Apologetics exists
to show you the goodness of God in movies we watch.
I'm movie apologist Clark.
And I'm Bethany.
And this is Movie Night Apologetics.